You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, my name is Jordan Lofthouse, and I'm a senior fellow with the Hayek Program at the Mercatus Center. In today's episode of the Hayek Program podcast, I'll be chatting with Zane Austin Willard about interdisciplinary scholarship and using political economy to study LGBTQ plus issues. But first, let me give a brief introduction to Zane, who's a doctoral student in the Department of Communication at the University of South Florida. His research and teaching interests are in critical media and cultural studies, surveillance studies, and gender and sexuality studies. In particular, his work analyzes popular culture and legal and political discourse, focusing on surveillance culture. His work emphasizes racialized, classed, and gendered dimensions of surveillance. And Zane's scholarship has been published in journals such as Communication, Culture, and Critique, the Journal of Communication Inquiry, Communication Teacher, and the International Journal of Performance Arts and Digital Media. He's participated in several years of the Mercatus Center's fellowships, including the Don LaVoie Fellowship, Frederick Bastiat Fellowship, and Eleanor Ostrom Fellowship. So welcome, Zane.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here, Jordan.
Yeah, so to start off, I'd like to know a little bit more about your academic background. For listeners who may not know, what exactly is the field of communication and what differentiates communication from other disciplines?
No, so that's a great question. So communication as a discipline is really born out of kind of a post-World War II context when we see kind of the birth of and kind of a big boom in terms of research being poured into universities, funding for research being poured into universities, and an interest in kind of the more knowledge-based economy and service-based economy, and an investment in like, what is this communication phenomena happening within organizations and whatnot. But as a discipline itself, it really didn't start to take form in terms of its own, for instance, having an academic department home up until 70s and 80s and whatnot, and it's disparate, of course, but generally speaking. And before, you'd find people that were doing work that was interested in issues that related to communication, human communication particularly, within sociology, anthropology, more social science fields, and even psychology per se. But then kind of on the flip side of that, what we've had since really the early 1900s was public speaking and journalism, which were seen as different from communication. These were separated out as two different lines of inquiry. And whereas public speaking took its grounding in rhetoric and the humanities and philosophy, finding itself in English departments particularly, that area of inquiry, and then we think about communication, as I was just speaking about, from like social science perspectives, alongside also journalism and mass communications, these were kind of three different threads that had been going on. And those didn't really start to come together until that kind of like late, 1970s, 1980s or so, when they all start coming together within different communication departments. But communication as a field, I oftentimes like to think about it as bringing together the social sciences like anthropology, sociology, some from psychology. And then also kind of on the flip side of that, really thinking about the history of rhetoric and the humanities and whatnot. And you have folks drawing from film studies, literature, art history, cinema studies, philosophy, and that communication as a discipline brings those together. And what you find within communication as a discipline is folks kind of working in different paradigms within the field. And so you have folks who we often, today, the language we often say is post-positivist. They're more social science oriented. Perhaps they use more quantitative methods. And they're oftentimes drawing from the histories of sociology, psychology, anthropology, and that kind of area of inquiry. And then you have other folks, what we say are in the interpretivist paradigm, who start to bring together a good blend of the two between drawing from the social sciences and the humanities and whatnot, and thinking about social construction. And then you have folks on the more critical and cultural humanistic side who, while still drawing from ideas and whatnot, particularly from sociology, are oftentimes interrelated with the histories of literature, English, film studies, and art history.
So in addition to your background in communication, you've had some training in economics, including a bachelor's degree in economics and obviously multiple years of participation in Mercatus's various fellowships. I'm curious, in your, you know, experience, how do you think about the connection between communication and economics? Like you said, communication is a very broad field from a variety of social sciences and, you know, humanities. But how does your training in communication influence the way you think about economics? And how does maybe the economic way of thinking influence the way you approach the study of communication?
Yeah, so I'll take it back a little bit and share a little bit more about my, I guess, academic journey and story and whatnot. I went into undergrad pursuing an economics degree, amongst other things and whatnot. But I had an affinity for economics and calculus. I loved calculus. and so that fitted well and whatnot. But I also had always, since early on in my life, had an interest in the humanities in different ways. But I never thought of myself as someone majoring in English and whatnot or anything of that sort. And kind of through an interest in film, particularly fell into the Department of Communication also. And I, throughout my undergraduate experience, pursued these degrees alongside one another. But when it came to economics, I did not have an affinity for statistics, but I was interested in ideas, in talking about issues of economic history, of the philosophy of economics, and kind of in my communication training, which was more grounded in film studies and media studies rather than like human communication per se, but analyzing pop culture and whatnot. I kept trying to reconcile with myself, what am I doing? how do these come together? When I graduate, I'm going to have this bachelor's in economics and communication and whatnot, and film, actually. how do I make those come together? And it wasn't until I, so for the listeners, I went to the University of Tampa for my undergraduate degree and worked with Dr. Abigail Hall, who's a Mercatus Fellow. And it wasn't until I took public choice with her, where we spent more time thinking about the philosophy of economics, of economic thinking, that I was like, oh, this is the space where these come together, right? I was never going to find that connection in like econometrics or something like that. I was like, okay, I have to take this class to graduate. Got it. But in that upper level elective course that I took with her, I was like, oh, this is it. And then we ended up doing an independent study together also before I graduated. And so I was like, I can bring this idea about my interest, my passion for talking about big ideas, grounded in critical theory to economics. So I was like, this is where I've kind of reconciled with myself a little bit. And then I ended up pursuing my graduate work is in communication, but still with a focus on interest in popular culture and legal and political discourse rather than like human communication per se, in terms of thinking about like folks who might do organizational communication work or interpersonal communication work. I still work within the realm of media studies and rhetoric, particularly. And so now I'm thinking through, get back to your question, doing the different Mercatus Fellowships, first the Don Lavoie and then the Bastiat and the Eleanor Ostrom Fellowship, gave me spaces to bring together my interest from rhetoric and media studies to the Mercatus Center's histories of working with Austrian, Virginia, and Bloomington schools, and thinking through these more philosophical ideas and whatnot, and they start to speak to one another.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it's interesting that kind of a public choice was your in to these, you know, kind of the economic way of thinking or these schools of thought, because that's exactly my background too. My undergrad was in geography, which, you know, also has very little to do with economics. I had never taken an economics class in my life. And when I was an undergrad, I did an internship. So I was at Utah State University. I did an internship in DC where I was, you know, in the House of Representatives, you know, just the lowly intern answering phones, sending mail, that kind of stuff. But, you know, as I was there, seeing kind of how the sausage is made, you know, a peek behind the, you know, the curtain of the Wizard of Oz a little bit, it was very interesting to see how things actually work on the ground. And to be honest, left me a little bit disillusioned. But then once I came back to finish up my undergrad at Utah State, that's where I had a friend introduce me to public choice. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is the kind of economics that's very interesting. Before then, I was like, economics, that's like finance stuff, like stocks and bonds stuff. Like, I didn't particularly care about that stuff. And so I was like, oh, public choice is a way to understand how policies are actually formed. You can actually have a systematic way of thinking about the incentives and constraints that people have when they're producing public policy, either on the elected side or the bureaucratic side. So that was kind of the way that, but yeah, it's interesting that public choice, I think, is really, I've heard this from a few people, but it really is kind of a light bulb moment that gets people interested in political economy in general.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that, yeah, that light bulb moment is a good way to put about, kind of highlight that. Yeah, because my communication and film studies training was so grounded in, and we can get into like critical theory and whatnot, coming from gender studies and critical race theory and things like that. And that was a space where I was like, oh, I was like, there's something here that I could start to bring some of these conversations into and open up new ideas and whatnot. And that's kind of like now in terms of thinking about continuing to do fellowships and thinking through these ideas and how they come together. And still, in some ways, I talked about you know, that reconciliation. I think I still sometimes find myself kind of continuously having a conversation with myself to justify, like, why am I in this space again? Like, what do I have to offer? Because I know I have something to offer in these spaces for sure. But articulating that, right? Like, clearly, more than anything else.
Yeah, and I think that's a great segue into my next question for you. I know in the past you've mentioned, hope I don't butcher this quote too badly, but I think you've mentioned something like, you found more often than not that you're, quote, you know, the most Marxist in a room full of capitalists and the most capitalist in a room full of Marxists. And you've said that you see this tension that you sit in is a productive space. I'm wondering if you can kind of elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by that, and in what ways is that tension that you feel productive for the way in which you analyze the world?
No, I love that you brought this up. I'm going to rewind just a little bit, and I want you to come back to this question in just a second, so because I think this is important. So to go back to what I was saying just a few moments ago about kind of communication as a broad discipline and where I situate myself, and like I said, between that those spaces of rhetoric and media studies, and this is relevant for this question, is that kind of alongside communication, and if you look at my work and whatnot, I am trained in the communication department, but my work really speaks to the larger intellectual project of cultural studies. And it's very funny that I've had people, when I say cultural studies, they're not familiar with what cultural studies is, as it's not a discipline, it is an anti-discipline. We'll talk about that in a second. I think of it as an intellectual project. But cultural studies is really kind of where I situate with myself. And in many ways that communication used to find itself, or communication folks would find themselves in sociology departments, anthropology departments and whatnot. Cultural studies folks, we still find ourselves in communication departments, English departments, sociology departments, anthropology departments, art history, et cetera. And so cultural studies as an area of inquiry is born out of a post-World War II context and the development of kind of a more robust middle class, this idea of a development of a popular culture, particularly this as an area of inquiry. This is happening in the UK and Great Britain post-World War II. And this idea that in terms of academic spaces, there were not scholars that were interested, particularly coming from the humanities and whatnot, that were invested in what were the masses interested in popular culture. So folks who, we oftentimes frame this as a distinction between high culture and low culture. Historically, people that are interested in studying high culture, such as like things we see as high culture, would be like Shakespeare, the ballet, the opera, these like things that are attuned with an upper echelon of society. Whereas popular culture is the things that we, and now that we come to understand and whatnot in a contemporary moment a little bit differently, but what are the majority of people in the world looking at? How is the middle class spending their free time? Where are they spending their free time? What are they spending their money on for their free time? You have the interest in the sitcom, right? The television, popular films, and things that, right, that could be enjoyed by mass audiences, not something that's like an independent auteur film. That only someone with a degree in film and interest in cinema theory could appreciate and whatnot. But like, for instance, today we might say an investment in the rom-com, right, as an important side of analysis. And then also, right, the art of the everyday in many ways. So how do we talk about our lives in the everyday? This was the interest of cultural studies. Like, why are we not paying attention to this? If we pay attention to what people are spending their time consuming and whatnot, we can get insight into like larger moments about culture. And so from there, British cultural studies evolves into an American cultural studies paradigm in the 1980s out of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the Institute of Communications Research. And then also in Australia as well during that time. And it's continued to become more robust and more disparate at the same time, taking it different spaces and places. So I share that because in terms of the history of cultural studies, it is deeply rooted in a Marxist paradigm, emphasizing that, like I said, in terms of even the way I was talking about it before, how are people spending their time? Right? What are they consuming? And also thinking about tangentially here, right? What are people being allowed to consume? What is available to them? What are the ideologies encoded in these forms of mass consumption and whatnot? From, you know, news media, television series, films, popular books, and things like that. And so an interest, right, in those relations of labor between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, right? That there is an emphasis here of how do we keep the masses behaving as they should for, you know, like to use, if we're talking about ideology, to use the language of Althusser, interpolation, the idea that people become who they are through ideology, that we, it is not something that we can necessarily escape. So I share that to say that in terms of where in which I situate myself is that these ideas are grounded in this Marxist history, and that coming from an economics background as well, particularly, right, not in a Marxist economics background, but in mainline political economy, right, how do you kind of reckon, once again, this notion of reconciliation, how do you reconcile those spaces and whatnot? And it's actually interesting. I feel like maybe I finally got my answer. It was at the last Eleanor Ostrom Fellowship earlier. I was talking to Nathan Goodman about this a little bit. And he was like, yeah, he's like, but there's something to be said between, you know, taking up a set of, you know, paradigmatic claims for making an argument and, you know, what you live in your day-to-day life, right? And that nothing that we necessarily write and research about translates perfectly to how we live our everyday lives, right? It's not that, you know, we have this deep value set that has to align with everything we write, read and write and whatnot, or we, you know, are fake academics or whatever, right? That we're lying to everyone, right? We all have a different kind of set of values and whatnot that we take on in research and writing. And so that it creates, for me sitting in these different spaces, right, to go back to the question, right, I often will say I'm the Marxist in a room, I'm oftentimes find myself being the Marxist in a room full of capitalists or the capitalist in a room full of Marxists. Maybe it's not quite that divisive, but it can feel like that sometimes. And I realize and that's kind of one of those spaces where I'm like, oh, this is my job. This is actually my purpose here. Like, this is why I enjoy sitting in this space. I'm meant to push the needle forward. Or maybe not even push it. Maybe I'm meant to hold the needle back a little bit, to pull the reins in. Like, okay, we all, for instance, I think about like at a Basquiat fellowship or something like that. Particularly in those spaces, I'm like, well, I'm showing up as the Marxist today in the room full of capitalists. And my job is to kind of pull back a little bit of the restraints in terms of, okay, we're getting a little bit away from, we're talking a lot about numbers and profit margins and, you know, not in profit, like optimization, right? But like, we need to think about the cultural context a little bit more. We need to think about, okay, what are the possible race relations or gender relations here, the class relations, right? That, you know, we can talk about what might seem optimal for a group of people, a society, the government writ large, whatever, right? But like, what are the actual like day-to-day lived experiences of people? And how can we rein that back in? Who is actually, what are those experiences and how can we continue to bring that back, okay? On the contrary, in the spaces I sit in, where I'm perhaps thinking of myself as the capitalist in the room full of Marxists, which is a little less common than maybe I think about it, particularly because communication as a field, like I said, communication as a field is not grounded in Marxism, but rather folks who take up a cultural studies approach to communication or critical cultural communication, we might also call it, will have that similar approach amongst other folks, depending on their paradigmatic preferences or, you know, theoretical orientations that they're taking to make their arguments. But what I find is that similarly, I'm like, okay, I'm like, well, we're spending a lot of time talking about getting caught up in the causes of what we want to achieve out of social justice, that we want to, you know, burn down the system and start over again. This isn't working for people, right? But what I find is I'm like, okay, and this is usually how I frame it is I'm like, no, and I hear you, right? There's people who are becoming more and more disenfranchised. We have severe wealth inequity, income inequity in this country, right? What can we do about that? And I'm like, well, as much as we'd love to sit around and say we need to burn down the whole system and start over again, we can't do that per se, right? I know we say that we can, and maybe we can in a perfect world, you know, just start over, right? But we can't. So what are those, maybe what we might call micro practices of resistance or those everyday instances of resistance or fighting back and whatnot that can lead to pragmatic change or positive changes and whatnot. At the same time, I want to also specify and note, right, there's always and there always should be a space for radical thinkers. We need radical thinkers in the room to push us forward. We need those voices. They keep us mobilized. They keep us hopeful for kind of a far off utopia, futurity that we may never reach, right? But we need people to be those spaces. And I always want to be those voices in these different spaces. A quote that I often draw on, and if anyone's listening who I've ever taken a graduate course with, they've heard me say this. I often cite Audre Lorde, a Black feminist writer, thinker, activist, Audre Lorde. And she famously said, "You can't tear down the master's house with the master's tools." And it's a quote that I love. It gives me, I've got chills right now even thinking about it. And right, that if we really want to create radical change, we can't be using the same tools and whatnot that we've had before. And that's one of those things I'm like, we need to keep that in mind. That needs to be at the top of everything that we're doing of like, yes, this is the problem with society, whatever we're trying to achieve and fix. But what is it that we can do today? And that might involve using the master's tools in the master's house, but that is something we can do today to achieve our larger goal. And it takes a network of people to overthrow a system, I guess we might say, or to really seek change and how we see that play out. So that's how I see that change. When I say it's productive, it's not that I necessarily think that like if I'm not in the room, things aren't going to happen, right? I don't think that's true. But what I do think is that I find myself, I'm like, you know, I have a very unique experience that has led me to the different spaces that I'm in and that I occupy. And if there's one thing that, you know, is me doing something positive, right, working towards some kind of larger, greater change and whatnot, it's bringing that point of discussion up, of being able to sit in a room with folks who, like I said, maybe they all come from, you know, more social science backgrounds and whatnot, have never been in the room with someone who is a gender studies scholar. Or on the opposite, I'm in a room full of gender studies scholars. They've never been in the room with someone who has economics training in those kinds of ways in those discussions. That I it's a privilege to be able to occupy that position and be able to share that, just to kind of introduce conversation with folks about those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's great. And as you were talking, I was thinking about how even though maybe kind of these tacit presuppositions of maybe a more Marxist, people with a Marxist foundation in analyzing the world versus a more mainline political economy, as you were talking, two ideas came up for me. One was power. I know that power is often a very core concept that people talk about in a more Marxist-framed paradigm. But I think even too, in public choice, the concern is constantly about power, even going to something like Buchanan's book, The Limits of Liberty, where he talks about the protective state, the productive state, and the predatory state. What is the predatory state but an abuse of power? And so it's interesting, like the rhetoric may be very different, but the concern about power and the abuse of power seems to be a commonality between kind of these two camps that seem to be at odds. And another thing that kind of that you were just mentioning there at the very end, both maybe the mainline political economy framework and a more Marxist framework are both interested in the processes of institutional change and social change. And they both bring different maybe analytical tools or analytical perspectives and how we understand how institutional change actually comes about. Like what role do entrepreneurs have? What role do, you know, institutional rules have? What role do, you know, we can go on and on and on. And again, there might be a lot of overlap, that there might be fruitful conversation, and sometimes they might disagree, but I think that's where both camps have to really articulate what the disagreement is and what they're actually disagreeing about. Is it analytical? Is it normative? I don't know if you have any reactions to that or any thoughts.
Well, no, and I think it just goes back to my earlier point of kind of like where I personally found an interest, right? Or where that there was that light, that aha moment, right? The light bulb goes off of like, oh yes, there is an overlap here, right? And it is those interests in you know, institutional dynamics, right? An interest in creating change or, you know, I think oftentimes when we're maybe in terms of a more economic way of talking about it, we use the language of like optimization, right? How can we make this more effective or more optimal and whatnot? And I think when you're looking at that kind of rhetoric from a, you know, a social justice warrior, you know, perspective, it seems like, oh, that's only emphasizing profits and whatnot. And it's like, well, but if we're making profits for perhaps those on the margins, on the disenfranchised, whatnot, whether those are like economic or excuse, accounting profits versus like economic profits, or we can find other ways of thinking about profit and what constitutes that, right? Then, well, no, that would be a positive, right? What is that redistribution and whatnot? And so sometimes I think that in these, you know, paradigmatic differences, we, you know, particularly, right, if folks don't have the training, not that everyone needs to be trained in everything to understand everything, right? That's not how that works. But we can oftentimes get caught up in the rhetoric of these things. And, you know, and we've had these discussions at fellowships before, you and I, amongst others, about like, right, we might use the same word to talk about different things, or we might be using different words to talk about the same thing. And oftentimes you need to kind of define our terms before we start having to have a more productive discussion. And sometimes I think when I hope that in the future we continue to have more and more spaces with folks from different, you know, areas of inquiry. And maybe, you know, what is a good way of kind of setting out some future ground rules for being able to have those more productive conversations. We're not getting caught up in kind of the way language can barrier us from, you know, connecting with one another.
Yeah. And I wanted to jump back to something you said a little while ago when you were kind of describing cultural studies and your placement within cultural studies. I'm wondering what's your operating definition of culture? Because I do know, you know, a lot of my colleagues are working in the economic sociology space, kind of, you know, founded on the work of Don Lavoie. You have, you know, scholars today like Virgil Storr or Emily Chamley Wright or Pete Betke working in this field of economic sociology, where culture is working in like the framework of Geertz, where you have culture is really a shared set of meanings. It's these shared sets of understandings. It's not something you can take, you know, you can't shed your culture. You might be embedded in multiple cultures at once. Within this kind of Geertzian framework, it's this shared set of meanings in which, I don't know, maybe a kind of a ham-fisted metaphor, but it's like a fish doesn't know that it's swimming in water necessarily. Like culture is something we're so embedded in. It shares our mental frameworks or ideologies that we don't always know what's there. So I'm wondering if culture to you is more like this mental framework thing. Is it more like practices? Is it more like the cultural goods that come out? Like you were saying, you mentioned before, you know, this distinction between high culture and low culture. I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
So, you know, what's interesting about cultural studies is that because it does take from these different, you know, what, as you're articulating, right, we think about a sociological understanding of culture as being the more, as you were just saying, like shared beliefs and values and whatnot. But then we also have an anthropological understanding of culture as an emphasis on like rituals, people's day-to-day interactions and activities and whatnot that constitute their cultures. But then also we have a more, we might say it's grounded in literature, English, like that, right? And interested in like the documents of history, or historical, we might say, and what art historians are looking at. What if we think about looking at old books and like literature scholars, or, you know, even today we think about looking back at in terms of different films and things like that. These documents and artifacts that we see as insights to culture. And cultural studies really takes all of those different approaches and whatnot. And it's one of those things of kind of like, well, what is it that you're looking at in terms of culture? Are you looking at the actual beliefs and behaviors and patterns and whatnot? And you're right, you might, you have cultural studies kind of has two paradigms, one that takes more ethnographic approaches of interviewing people, doing, you know, in the field work, participant observation, those kinds of methods and whatnot. And another paradigm that takes more textual approaches of looking at documents and histories and things like that. And that each of these, right, they are all different types of culture. However, really, what's in terms of kind of zooming out just a little bit, if we're thinking about kind of an overarching definition of culture within cultural studies that sees each of these different ones, the sociological, the anthropological, and the historical, as different iterations of ways we can talk and understand culture, is an understanding of culture as a terrain of struggle. I know that seems really metaphorical. This comes from Stuart Hall, who's one of the founding fathers of cultural studies and media studies. He's part of that group that was born out of the first iteration of British cultural studies in the 1960s. And Stuart Hall, when he's talking about culture as a terrain of struggle, is that there are so many different things that are happening at once in our in society at one time, right? That for us to be able to have an actual understanding of what is culture, right, that there is a competing terrain between the dominant and the resistant classes, as to whenever we go and understand culture to study culture, there's going to be something that prevails whenever we're talking about culture. There is no just one, right, that everyone living today in this exact moment is understanding culture in the exact same way, right? But if this is one part where context, which is critical to cultural studies, is that everything when we're looking at it has to be understood in its historical and social context that we're talking about it. If we're going to talk about, for instance, the culture of Tampa, Florida, where I'm at today, right? If we're talking about the culture of Tampa, Florida today, even if we're just talking about it today on October 23rd versus pre-hurricane a month ago on September 23rd, there's going to be differences that we would want to account for how people are living their everyday lives, what matters to people and whatnot, right? We have to have that context when we're speaking about things. So to think about culture as the competing terrain of struggle between not just the dominant and resistance, but competing ideologies, because when we go to study something, we're going to go look at something analytically, whether that's from the more anthropological, the sociological, or the historical, right? There's something that is always going to be brought in and something that's always going to be left out in that understanding. Okay. And so for us to really think about what is that overarching understanding of culture to try to, like, quote unquote, homogenize a culture, and not even homogenize, right? But to think about, you know, finding something that we can analyze and whatnot to talk about, we're thinking about that terrain of struggle because there's so many competing discourses happening at once. And once we're able to, what kind of emerges from that is what we're able to actually kind of talk about and analyze. I'm hoping that's clear.
Yeah, I'm curious. So this struggle, like you said, again, it seems like there's this a power difference that you're talking about there between, I can't remember the exact words you just used, but the kind of the higher class and the lower class, meaning a class with more power and a class with less power. Do you think that necessarily fits in all contexts? Is that ubiquitous across every society at all times? Or can culture be... can there be instances where culture is not based on struggle between people?
Well, I would clarify that it's not necessarily struggle between people, but that we're talking about a struggle between different ideologies, right? That this is, we think about ideology as many ways, like false consciousness as one way of talking about it, right? The ideas and principles and values of society about not just how society is, but how society ought to be, if we're talking about ideology from that perspective, right? So it's not necessarily that, you know, everywhere that we're talking about culture that there must be war or something like that, right? But that within any given context, that there is some kind of competing terrain of a dominant and resistant, or maybe not even, but a dominant and a, I don't want to say, subverted, not just necessarily social class or anything of that sort, but I'll say with ideology to be broad and whatnot, of that there's something that is emerging as dominant and something that's resistant. Doesn't mean we can't talk about what that resistant ideology is. Doesn't mean that we can't talk about what that is. But when we're talking about any kind of idea about what constitutes a culture, we have to understand that all of these things are playing out on this terrain at once. Within that, I can dial into different spaces and places. So for instance, if we're talking about, like we'll get to here in a second, I believe queer culture in the US and whatnot, queer popular culture, and we're talking about different ways that that might be taken up. So we might have something, if we're talking about, in terms of thinking about culture as a terrain of struggle, if we're talking about something like we're gonna analyze RuPaul's Drag Race, that is a very like emergent, dominant media text, cultural artifact of our present time that is indicative of and reflects a queer popular culture in many ways, right? That'd be one way for us to talk about it, right? But in that same way, we're talking about queerness and queer popular culture, right? That's kind of a mainstream dominant. It's emerged as kind of hegemonic in many ways within the domain of queer popular culture. But against that, right, there's also still drag queens performing in bars. There's drag queens who are performing in ways that would not be quote unquote suitable for national television. That maybe subvert sex and sexuality and kink and fetish, maybe in particularly different types of ways that we wouldn't see on, you know, on mainstream television, on reality television, that are still a part of what constitute queer popular culture, right? Those experiences, right? And we can still analyze those and whatnot. But when we're talking about culture, it's this shifting, those shifting ideologies are competing with one another, even though we have the one that's seen as more popular, as more ideologically successful or commercially successful, excuse me. Right? They're both still existing there in the same space and time. It's just a matter of how we want to talk about them.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect segue to jump into the other topic I wanted to talk about, which you and I are just starting off on a paper together where we're looking at, you know, the expansion of rights and privileges for queer people, focusing mainly on the United States, and how market and non-market entrepreneurs have kind of reshaped and reformed formal and informal institutions that have led to, you know, more or less queer liberation in a relatively short period of time. And I think that's really interesting that you just said kind of this, in some ways, there's a trade-offs, maybe tensions. So in the sense that we can think of something like RuPaul's Drag Race as, you know, a piece of media that has in a lot of ways led to the mainstreaming, the wider acceptance of queer identities and queer expressions and queer art forms. But also, it seems like there might be tensions there too, where it one type of art form expression is prioritized over others. And so what does that do to those others? I know that you recently had a paper published on this topic. I'd love to hear your thoughts on kind of maybe that tension and how we situate that.
Yeah, so this is actually, in many ways, the crux of my research, the crux of my dissertation project now, is considering what has become acceptable mainstream queer visibility and representation in popular culture and what has, you know, been relegated as not. and this ties back to a larger idea about what we call the paradox of visibility. In that sense, particularly in terms of queerness, and when I say queerness, if we want to be more specific, the first successful representations of lesbian and gay people in the media. We think about Will and Grace. We even think about when Ellen DeGeneres first came out on television. We think about Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, the original Queer Eye, right? That there were these acceptable representations of gays and lesbians particularly. And that's gone on and whatnot. But for the most part, we're presented with the same picture of the cisgender, normally white, gay man, probably in a monogamous relationship with another cisgender, probably white, gay man. Same thing in terms of lesbian identity and whatnot. That's really the narrative that we're presented with the most part, broadly speaking. And there are a few exceptions, you know, throughout. But broadly speaking, this is what we call homonormative politics. Homonormativity, if we're familiar with the concept of heteronormativity being the idea that the prevailing ideology in terms of relationships and sexuality in general, I'm saying the U.S., but, you know, even more broadly than that, is, you know, the man, husband and wife and the 2.5 kids with the white picket fence, right? And that the homonormativity, this is credited to Lisa Dugan, to give her credit. Homonormativity is this idea that the acceptable gay and lesbian subject filled that exact same trope, but just with, you know, two men or two women, right? We're still talking about monogamy. We're still talking about marriage. We're still talking about having children, adopting children, whatever. And that this is like the primarily like thinking about marriage is like an economic institution and a political institution. And from there on, then we start to see the entrance of trans folks, transgender characters into different popular television series. And what we call the transgender tipping point, which is famously credited to Time magazine in 2014, when they had Laverne Cox on the cover. Laverne Cox was an actress who was in, a Black trans woman actress and activist who was in one of the first original Netflix series, Orange is the New Black, when she was on the cover with the title The Transgender Tipping Point. And since 2014, we have seen a rapid rise in trans and gender nonconforming characters and storylines on different TV series, such as like Grey's Anatomy. There was an Amazon Prime series called Transparent. We had different reality TV shows that covered trans folks' lives, such as I Am Jazz, which covered documented the life of Jazz Jennings, who was a young trans woman, or is a young trans woman, who was documenting her transition on this TLC show and whatnot. However, since 2014, what has also happened, and this is really worth about the paradox of visibility, is that while we've had this increased representation, particularly of trans folks in popular culture, is that we've also had a rapid rise in the violence and surveillance and scrutiny of trans and gender nonconforming folks as well. And in recent histories, we think about the current emphasis on a rise in legislation targeting trans youth healthcare and trans healthcare writ large. We think about increased policing of drag performances. If you recall, in 2023, we had, it ended up being 6 different U.S. states that passed legislation banning drag performances in public places. And the reason that while it was, you know, framed under this guise of drag being the what needs to be surveyed and scrutinized in those ways, the underlying fear was this would be a way to police trans people. Because in many of those bills, the rhetoric was framed as anyone impersonating someone other than the sex of their biological sex, which was just another way of saying essentially trans people could be vilified for just existing in public spaces. So we've seen this increased scrutiny in their data and statistics about in terms of the increased violence and murders and deaths of particularly trans women of color who are the most vulnerable in these spaces. So there's that. Kind of, for lack of a better term, catch-22 that happens. I mean, this is something that queer and trans media studies scholars like myself have been writing about and continuing to interrogate and whatnot and think about how we can have these conversations about what we are currently seeing in media that might be presented as positive, but really underlying those positive representations are the same old ideologies regarding that. And so when we think about Drag Race, particularly, and RuPaul's Drag Race, so for the listeners who maybe aren't familiar with the concept of RuPaul's Drag Race is a mainstream competitive reality television series hosted by RuPaul, Andre Charles, who is drag queen, very famous drag queen. If you're not familiar, you can look her up and whatnot. And it's her show that she hosts. And like most reality television competition shows, participants engage in weekly challenges that assess acting, singing, dancing, comedy, and whatnot. And each week, someone is eliminated up until the final episode of the season, and then someone's crowned America's Next Drag Superstar. It first started in 2009, and now, come January 2025, the 17th season will be airing on MTV. But along that time, since 2018, it now has, I think it's 17 different international franchises, two of which Drag Race UK is hosted by RuPaul, but other ones are hosted by other drag queens that are famous in their respective countries. And it's gone on to have different like international versions where they bring in queens from who have competed on different franchises across the globe, who maybe RuPaul has never seen before, but what they are calling like kind of a global all-stars, kind of like a redemption where people who don't win the first time can come back and compete again to try to win. For RuPaul, actually currently right now, this week is the finale of the first global all-stars series where they had one queen from each of the 12 different countries where there's a franchise come and compete in front of RuPaul to be crowned the global Glamazon or global the best queen in the world and whatnot is what they're archiving for or reaching for. But part of what this paper that Jordan's talking about is with alongside my MA advisor, Dr. Rachel Dubrovsky, who's actually born out of my master's thesis where I worked with her on this. And we were fortunate to turn it into a paper for communication, culture, and critique. Is that we examine one of the first iterations of this kind of global all-stars. It's not the one that I was just speaking about. They had an earlier version called UK versus the World, where they filmed it in the United Kingdom, where they filmed Drag Race UK. And they had, I think it was six different countries represented. I'd have to look at it. But it became very clear throughout that the queens that did well, that RuPaul liked, were very familiar with American and British cultural references. English was their first language. Because a large part of the series is being able to make RuPaul laugh, of being able to really being able to understand RuPaul's cultural references. And so you had contestants from Thailand, you had contestants from Canada, you had contestants from the Netherlands who didn't necessarily have that same cultural dossier, I guess, of what is funny, what does RuPaul think is funny. It doesn't necessarily always translate, not just from culture to culture, but even from your native tongue to English always. So you maybe you're proficient in English, being funny in English and being able to speak English are two very different things. And so what we see throughout it is that the one queen, particularly from Thailand, who's the only queen from a non-Western country, she was originally framed in the beginning of the series as being exceptional. She was winning the most. She was seen as the front runner and whatnot. And then when she has her great demise right before the finale where she's eliminated, it is this over-the-top emotional succumbing to, oh, I've let down my country, I've let down all of Thailand, I've let down my people, and she's eliminated and whatnot. But she's very much othered compared to all of her English-speaking and Western participants or co-contestants and whatnot, who did not have this same like grand demise of their time on the show, and really presents her, once again, this othering of the East, of the Orient and whatnot, juxtaposed against the West. So that's one way that we see just within the drag race kind of world that there are certain types of drag that are favored and whatnot. And something that I'm sure that I'm going to write about, I actually was hoping to write a kind of a journalistic cultural criticism piece about this is in this current, like I said earlier, Drag Race Global All-Stars that they have on right now, where they're examining the different, having the different one queen from 12 different countries compete for the title of Global All-Stars and whatnot. We've seen this exact same iteration happen again, like Rachel and I write about in the piece, of the queens who English is their first language, who are from the UK or Australia or the United States have done well. And then the queens who have struggled, who speak, you know, good English and whatnot, but maybe have struggled with their English on the show, struggled to be funny the way that RuPaul would think they are funny, translating from Spanish to English or German to English or French and whatnot to English and whatnot doesn't always translate. They have not done as well. So we're at the 12 participants they started with, we're at the final four. Three of those final four, RuPaul has judged before. They're from Australia, the US, and the UK. And English is their first language and whatnot. And there's only one girl in the final four from Italy who English is not her first language, who actually people would probably say upon watching the show and knowing other things about the drag race world, say that she struggled with English the most and whatnot, but managed to kind of be funny for RuPaul. And so we've seen that same thing kind of play out and whatnot. So even just within the drag race world, we see this kind of favoring of what is, you know, if we're giving RuPaul the license to decide who's the best drag queen in the world, because we don't have anything else like this, right? What does it say when we're the best drag in the world is always someone whose first language is English, comes from a Western country, more often than not is white or light skinned. What does that say about how we see drag culture?
Yeah. And as you were talking, that made me think about kind of a previous conversation we were having about social change and institutional change over time. So given kind of this concept that you mentioned of homonormativity, where there's quote unquote acceptable forms of gay and lesbian relationships and self-expression, and then, you know, more or less acceptable forms of trans expression. So in the case of something like RuPaul's Drag Race, where there's kind of an emphasis on Westernness or whiteness or homonormativity, or, I mean, whatever category we want to analyze at any given time, let me present something to you and you can push back or agree or fill in the blanks. Could that potentially be a stepping stone to wider acceptance for less visible forms of self-expression or relationships? So, for example, like you were just talking about this othering, does at first an othering give an opportunity to gain wider acceptance over time? Now that, say, like this, I think you mentioned a Thai drag queen was the one that was kind of had to make this big performance about letting down her country. Do you see that as maybe an opportunity? Now we might have normative feelings that that is a bad thing, but maybe over time that gives a chance for wider acceptance, a wider viewpoint of quote unquote acceptable or visible forms of drag. The reason I bring this up is I'm even thinking about the evolution of RuPaul's Drag Race over time, where before there was only cisgender gay men were allowed to be on the show. And now there are trans people who are not only on the show, but celebrated as being trans and a drag queen on the show. And maybe that started from at first an othering, but then later became more widely accepted. I'm curious if you have thoughts or reactions to what I just said or pushback.
No, I'm glad that you brought this up, because I think like most things, it's a yes and, right? Yes, maybe. So, right, I'm glad that you brought up, right, in terms of thinking about Drag Race's origins, right? We only had cis gay men on the series who were drag queens and whatnot. Notably, in the second season, Kylie Sonique Love came out as trans kind of after the show, but on during their reunion episode, like after they had filmed. But even then, we didn't have an actual someone walk into the series on episode one as an out trans person, trans woman, until the ninth season of the series, almost a decade later and whatnot. And for those who, you know, may not be familiar in terms of like drag culture and the history of ballroom and things like that, very much the leaders in the actual drag community, in queer nightlife communities, are trans women of color. And whatnot. So that didn't happen, right? And this was not, you know, not taken without, you know, pushback. RuPaul most certainly received pushback for these different things. And then there was a discussion about, well, maybe trans women, but before they have surgery, if they've had any kind of breast augmentation or any kind of biological augmentation, then they can't compete. And eventually that was pushback too. And actually now, you know, we've had a cisgender woman on the series in the UK and in Spain, I think. I don't think there's been one on the US series. And there was a lot of pushback for that, because part of, you know, the argument that people have is that part of the drag performance is creating the illusion, or that you have to create the female form in somewhat. And also what we haven't had at all on RuPaul's Drag Race as someone is coming on as a drag king. So someone who identifies as a woman out of drag, but puts on a masculine persona as a drag king. We haven't had that on Drag Race at all yet. And there's a lot of push for that to happen by fans and whatnot, that this needs to change somehow. So that's kind of one of those tensions that has to happen, and that you're kind of working with RuPaul as, like, you know, I'd have to go find it, but there is an article that was published in Celebrity Studies in 2020. I can remember that. I can't remember who wrote it, where they describe RuPaul as ultimate queen. It's kind of like, this is the gatekeeper in many ways. They talk about RuPaul. But to get back to your point about othering, I think, So Pangina is the name of the Thai drag queen that I was talking about that was on that one series. And I want to be clear, and when we're talking about media and doing media analysis, we never actually know who these people are or what they think or what they're doing per se. All we know is how they are presented to us. So in terms of Pangina's reaction and whatnot, this is on RuPaul's Drag Race UK versus the World, if anybody wants to go watch it, is that she breaks down into tears. And there's a way that, right, she did break down into tears. The camera captures that, that there is an authenticity to that moment. This is another part of my work, is authenticity, right? That we know this happened because it's caught on camera. But the overdramatization of that happens in the editing process, and that the ways in which after that we see a cutback between the judging panel where they have their head in their hands. We see RuPaul kind of take a pause before she tells her that she's eliminated. We're almost left in suspense of, like, is she going to save her because she's been doing good this whole time? We see a cut between the different contestants who are also just in shock, right? All of those production aspects, Pangina didn't do that. She's not the one presenting herself like that. The series is presenting herself like that. The series is othering her in this way of making it dramatic, of making it over the top, right? And so I think that there's a way when we're talking about, you know, do we see othering as kind of a part of the larger step towards social change? I don't think it's a requirement for doing, you know, pushing the needle forward. I think we'll look back and see, oh, well, that was a step in the right direction. I do think that. But I think in terms of today, when if we need to other someone to get them in the spotlight, I think we need to find ways to not do that. I don't think that we need to have for instance, if we were going to have a drag king on RuPaul's Drag Race, season 18 or 17 or whatever, right? We don't need to make a spectacle out of them to justify their presence there. They can just be there because they're a good drag artist. And then, of course, I understand this is kind of niche and whatnot, because other things have happened over time that Drag Race is, by introducing these conversations on mainstream, well, now mainstream, before, you know, it was kind of on the niche LGBTQ network logo TV up until season 9, and then it moved to VH1 and now it's on MTV, but kind of becoming more and more mainstream, winning Emmys and things like that now. But it has introduced discussions and conversations about things over time that have changed. For instance, like talking about trans healthcare and access to trans healthcare, we see the queens talking about this kind of in between challenges and things like that on the series. I had to kind of destigmatize some of those things, or talking about being HIV positive as something, having that conversation in the effort of you know, it is done in the service of destigmatizing it. That's why they want to talk about it on the platform they have. You have other folks. There was notably a couple queens who were at Pulse in Orlando in 2016 at the shooting, or, and they knew those girls from those bars and whatnot. And they've talked about that and talking about gun violence and things like that. So the series does take up a platform in destigmatizing and having broader conversations about some of these things. And they're relegated to some of those kinds of things. We haven't, you know, necessarily seen, maybe presented in a positive light per se, anything regarding, you know, for instance, polyamorous couples. That's kind of more disparate. Oftentimes people talk about their partners and whatnot, but hasn't really had like a broad discussion about polyamory or having multiple partners is one other kind of queer topic that hasn't been touched on as much. Having some discussions in terms of things maybe related to like kink or fetish practices. Instead of being on Drag Race, there's actually another series, drag competition series called Dragula, the Boulay Brothers Dragula. And it functions similarly to Drag Race, but it's on a very niche streaming platform, AMC's horror platform, Shudder. And that is very niche, but they focus on like horror and filth and glam and things like that, and these more subversive presentations of drag performance. And that becomes a space where I've seen some of those discussions happening more that are still seen as very kind of taboo, maybe for something on MTV that's, you know, dealing with multimedia national companies and things like that. So there's, even at the same time we say that Drag Race, you know, it's moving the needle forward. And like I said, maybe we're not going all the way there, but because of what Drag Race has done and has happened and been successful, we're able to have something like Dragula, like I was just talking about, that can be a space for maybe these more subversive or othered niche presentations of drag performance and identity that we might not necessarily get yet or ever on an MTV show.
Yeah, I mean, this is really fascinating, the way that you've been analyzing the way that maybe RuPaul as an entrepreneur has, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, but in a lot of ways with, say, the larger queer community, it's been kind of two steps forward, one step back in a lot of ways, in the sense that, like you were saying, a lot of destigmatization, a lot of conversations that wouldn't normally make it onto mainstream TV are now in mainstream TV. But again, there may be subsets or subcultures that are not as showcased or highlighted. And so in those cases there. So do you think that is an inadequate way of framing it, two steps forward or one step back? Or would it just be kind of just different tensions? Maybe an entrepreneur can't do everything at once. I'm not sure how you reconcile that.
I do use the language of kind of two steps forward, one step back a little bit. And this is kind of what I describe as the productive work of cultural criticism, of that oftentimes, particularly when we're thinking about being queer and trans media studies scholars, of looking at these things, is that we're continuously getting things that are kind of, you know, better and better. And we have to acknowledge, like, yes, everything that we're getting for the most part is kind of going forward a little bit. And I think oftentimes, especially in my classes when I'm teaching, and they're like, why is everything so negative all the time? You know, they're like, isn't this supposed to be a good thing that we're looking at, or a positive representation? For instance, we kind of unpacked some of the normativities in the Marvel film Black Panther in my class. And we thought this was really positive. I'm like, it is, but we can still continue to, you know, dissect and analyze and whatnot. We can kind of be seen as these curmudgeons and whatnot as critics. And we're like, no. All of our things are meant to be productive. Like, yes, this is good. Now, how can we make it better? We need to tease this out. Or is something only on the surface level really progressive? But when we dive underneath it, we're still seeing the same old tropes just painted in different colors time and time again. It is very much two steps forward, one step back is one way to articulate it. But I think it's always kind of acknowledging that, yes, this is successful, but we can continue to interrogate and unpack.
That's great. And switching now to another topic that you've written on and worked on to kind of wrap up our conversation. So you've written on polycentric governance as it relates to the Me Too movement. In that research, you've looked at overlaps among ideas in the Bloomington School, economic sociology, and cultural studies along this. So I'm wondering how you kind of, in relation to the Me Too movement, how you see those overlaps between all of these various fields of study, and what insights have you gained in this research of the Me Too movement by combining Bloomington School, economic sociology, and cultural studies?
Yeah, so in thinking about that work with the Me Too movement, my kind of entrance into thinking about how can these come together begins really with my imperative about what I think is the work of cultural studies, which is looking at the timely and pressing issues of our time. Anytime I start a new piece, I need to have some kind of imperative as to, like, why is this important? Like, why is this significant? Right? And Me Too, and it's, you know, I guess it's unfortunate grandiosity in many ways, is like, right, it's one of those things. Yes, it's had a positive culture shift, but very much like, you know, it's a, you know, unfortunate topic, but one that needs discussing. And what I've seen with that, there's been different kind of critics of the Me Too movement, but different ways of really trying to make sense of how the movement's success happens in these digital spaces and the ways in which it's taken up, not just on social media platforms, but also in the larger media writ large. How are people seeing this in their everyday lives? What are the political outcomes, for instance, the legislation that we've seen pass, and the larger, you know, kind of reckoning and holding people accountable. And also, right, in this ongoing, tension of people being held accountable and then not being held accountable, and who's in a position of power, and what are the institutions at hand that are holding people accountable, and what is that relationship? But when thinking about how I kind of have brought all of those together, is in an effort to kind of reorient a new way of, not necessarily a new way, but a different perspective of considering the possibilities of polycentricity. This is one of those spaces and places, like we were talking about at the beginning, of where, you know, I see my position, you know, really occupying within the project of cultural studies and being attuned to what's going on in the world. And not to say that other people aren't attuned to it, but right, the purpose of the cultural studies is identifying the popular, identifying the political in these ways. So thinking about Me Too and polycentricity, I was like, okay, so we've got this social movement that is noted for the way that its success and its, like I said before, kind of grandiosity is attributed to its dispersion on social networks and connecting people online, and the ways in which we saw that not just in the digital space, but in material physicality too, like I was just saying. And then thinking about polycentricity, and I'm like, well, I see this as like very much a polycentric, you know, framework, network going on here. We have kind of different operating localities that are happening both independently and yet also interdependently upon one another, right? But the fact that it was happening in the digital and the material at the same time, I was like, we need a kind of a way. I said polycentricity works here, but we need to find a new way of articulating it. And so the work in that book chapter is thinking about I use the idea of connective action, which has been taken up over the last decade or so, that stems from collective action and our understanding of collective action. But how does that happen in online network spaces where there isn't like a physical co-presence, right? how can we use that to think about a new way of articulating polycentricity in this way, if we bring in connective action and understand these are connective networks that are still happening interdependently of one another. And really, you know, that was kind of part one of that work. And part two of it was then understanding the power dynamics at play here of like, okay, within this, we understand that there is a larger kind of inequity that happened with the way Me Too unfolded. For those listening, if you're not familiar, Me Too, the Me Too movement actually began in 2006 with Tarana Burke, who is a Black woman who began a survivor network of folks, of women, particularly women of color, who'd experienced sexual assault and sexual violence. And that is where Me Too started. This is before the hashtag or anything like that. But then in the wake of, you know, the kind of larger reckoning on sexual assault, the hashtag was added. It began taking it prominence on Twitter, particularly white woman celebrity Alyssa Milano. Was really accredited with really kind of, you know, mobilizing this hashtag on spaces and whatnot. And as scholars, particularly I'll plug my master's thesis advisor, Rachel Dubrovsky, in her article with Marina Levina in Critical Studies in Media Communication, where they talk about the ways in which the movement was co-opted by white women and kind of diluted of its Black feminist origins. Right. And so and being able to talk about connective action and polycentricity and how those come together, understanding this network, really what I think about it is that for myself as a cultural studies scholar who is deeply invested and has to be talking about issues of power and disenfranchisement, I can never just stop there. I have to go the next step to that critical ethic is what I call it, kind of having this critical ethic of myself of being attuned to these power relations, right? And so understanding that, well, yes, and you know, we can still understand, if we understand polycentricity or the Me Too movement as this polycentric model through connective action, what's still happening though is that while we have interdependent centers of kind of like what is the mainstream understanding of Me Too as this kind of white womanhood and whatnot that is seen as the, you know, the kind of the victim survivor narrative and whatnot that takes up the dominance within the cultural conversation, right? That's what in its own kind of independent but yet dominant narrative. We still also have a movement grounded in Black feminist origins happening. It just hasn't had the same necessarily visibility, right, that it's had, and in that visibility has kind of become devoid of it. They're still all operating interdependently, right? And I'm using these two examples, but as that work also points out, there's other kind of tangential movements about sexual assault and sexual violence that stem from Me Too, such as Girls Like Us, which was about trans women of color experiencing sexual violence and sexual assault. Another book that I'll plug that does a lot of this work is called Hashtag Activism, Networks of Race and Gender Justice by Sarah Jackson, Moya Bailey, and Brooke Foucault-Wells. Published by MIT Press, where they talk about not just Me Too, but these other hashtag activist movements, particularly from a Black feminist standpoint and an investment in thinking about information communication technologies in these relationships. So I highly recommend that if that is of interest to anyone to look at these things further. So really, I was picking up a lot of what they were talking about in the book, Jackson and her co-authors, and then thinking about it within this polycentric framework. So these things can be happening at multiple centers. And I think what actually offers us a place to think more productively and forward thinking and whatnot is, well, if we understand these as kind of happening interdependent of one another, then how is a way that we can provide a little bit more visibility, a little bit more traction per se for these different marginal communities who are still, like I said, operating independently, but haven't gotten the same visibility. So what is it there that we can do? And so one thing that I point out is that, I'm sure folks are familiar, the famous popular academic, I'd call her Brené Brown. Known for her TED Talks about vulnerability and whatnot. She's a social worker professor, a scholar of social work. She ended up co-editing a book with Tarana Burke, the initial founder of Me Too, on a collection of essays from Black academics, Black activists and whatnot, not just about Me Too, but about social movements and social justice oriented around Blackness and writing back against Black violence and whatnot, particularly in a post-George Floyd 2020 racial reckoning status. And I see that as like kind of one way of moving that dial a bit forward, of reorienting kind of these power centers, of shedding visibility on different spaces. Those of us in places of power and privilege, how can we uplift and shed light on these other narratives? And so I see that what Brené Brown did and that does it as co-editing that collection with Tarana Burke, being second author on it, all of these different kind of epistemological decisions and choices, right, can lead to, or had the possibility for us to lead to think about kind of like lifting up these different centers and whatnot, that they can be happening on equal, possibly, maybe equitable is a better word, equitable playing fields if we're thinking about a polycentric system, as opposed to thinking about having a dominant narrative and multiple minor narratives.
So if I were to kind of, well, let me restate one way or reframe maybe what you said, and you tell me if you agree with the way that I'm reframing it. So this polycentric approach to resolving these issues with, say, like sexual assault for women has been generally successful in achieving its goal. But even within this polycentric approach, there are still some normative concerns, such as the lack of visibility for certain groups, especially like, say, even the founder of this group. Is that a fair assessment?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a much more concise way of
putting it. Okay. No. I mean, everything you said made sense. It's just, that's because we can still have polycentric approaches that solve social problems, but, or solve might be a strong word, at least, you know, address to some degree social problems. But it doesn't mean that they're perfect. It even reminds me of like even bigger issues with polycentric governance structures. So to the degree that the federalist system of the United States, you know, to some degree, we might have certain states that have kind of oppressive laws. And in that degree, we might, even though there may be problems within those localities, those are problems we still have to address or at least think about. So, yeah, I think that is maybe one issue with polycentricity that often comes up is, I'm all gung-ho about polycentricity, me personally, but we have to be very careful not to say, oh, just slap some polycentricity on it and everything will be good. It's like, no, there, even in a polycentric system that generally has good outcomes, in sub areas of a polycentric system, you can actually have really bad outcomes. And those are the things we should often focus on. I don't know. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, what using, you know, a polycentric model can help you do is to identify those localities where things aren't working, right? It's not just to say that, you know, oh, it's a polycentric system. Ah, yes, it's working. Okay, well, now that we've identified where these different kind of independent, you know, for instance, you know, right, talking about different states and whatnot. Okay, well, now we can, you know, address attention here, right, to fix or solve or absolve or, you know, work towards those different problems. So, it definitely has possibilities for positive change, right, as we were talking about.
Great. I think that is a lovely place to end our conversation. Thank you again, Zane Austin Willett, for joining us today on the HIAC Program podcast.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the HIAC Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the HIAC Program, visit hiac.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.